only sell window that would open. Everyone knew that. She plunged her arm at the barred window, searching against the stone wall outside, and came up empty. She tried again and again. Empty. Then she climbed back down. Ori watched without comment, confusion all over her face. I'd have to warn her about showing so much of herself so easily.
"There's this plant," Peaches explained to her, "like this vine. I need it. But it looks like the last bitch who was in here smoked that shit all up."
She shot a glance at me that I did not return. "Need it?" Ori said. "For what?" Peaches smirked and twisted her lips. She turned to me.
"You sure you don't want nothing, Amber?"
"Nope," I said.
"Not a little story to read?"
"No thanks."
Her attention shifted to my celly.
"You?"
Ori eyed the both of us. She must have sensed that something was up. Then quietly, "I guess I don't feel much like reading. Maybe later?" Peaches snorted, like she'd said something funny.
"Okay, killer, suit yourself."
She wheeled the cart away, onto the next cell. The skip and slide of the wheels, the slide, the skip. Ori's face was stricken.
"Do you think she knows? Does everybody know?"
"What do you mean?"
"She called me..."
She couldn't say it. I shrugged.
She peeked out into the open space at the center of B-Wing, where Peaches was wheeling away my cart.
"You wanted a book, didn't you?"
I shrugged once more.
"I could tell."
She waited for me to say more, but I wasn't going to. Obviously, I wasn't. But then I did.
"She took it from me," I said.
"What? A book? Like, which one?"
I shook my head, wishing I hadn't uttered a word.
"Not just one, all of them, everything. She took everything."
She had this dense look on her face, as though she struggled with it, trying to understand.
"Can't you just ask for them back? Explain it to her?"
I scoffed. "You don't understand this place at all."
"But,"
she started. I waved her off.
"Don't talk about things you don't know," I said. "Chow time soon. Don't ever eat the peas or the meatloaf. The days that suck are the days we have both peas and meatloaf, so those are the days you don't eat. Be sure to sit with me. Make sure to throw away your fork and spoon when you're done, or they'll search you. Don't look at me like that. They're plastic, you'll learn."
It wasn't until the night, when we were alone again, and more alone than before because our door was sealed in the frame and its lock was turned and we couldn't get out this time, though once we had, it wasn't until this moment that she again chose to talk to me. She'd been quiet all through counts and dinner, all through after-dinner social and after-dinner counts. She'd been quiet as we undressed in front of each other. And when the locks turned, a momentous occasion for any girl's first night in Aurora Hills, I kept quiet myself to let her have her moment. We got into our beds, the lights went down, and B-Wing hushed. I let my eyes close. I didn't think of her attacking me with a carved eye gouger made from a plastic spoon, even though I hadn't seen for sure if she'd properly disposed of her plastic spoon, because I knew what I knew from before. I also knew other things, unremembered things. And it was only with my eyes closed and the blackness coming in to cover me that I sensed the tug and tickle that indicated they might come back. What I was forgetting, I mean. What we all were. I rolled over, away from it. I drifted. The walls held me close. I let my bare feet touch the bare wall, which was cold even in hot weather, eternally cold. The way I liked it. I found it comforting. I sank. Then she woke me.
Amber?
I tossed over, my name a distant bobbing thing I didn't need to pull from the water.
Amber?
I let an arm drop. I let a foot leave the wall.
Amber, are you awake?
I cocked one eye open. This, here, this was my angry face. Now I am.
You were humming.
I wiped the dribble of spit from my mouth, and the slick on my flat, rock-hard pillow made me have to turn the pillow over to try the other side, which felt even more flat and even more like a rock. I wouldn't be able to get back to sleep so easily now.
Sorry. I thought you were awake.
I wasn't. I looked up and could see her dangling, muscled leg.
What's that song you were humming?
Don't know. I was asleep.
A long moment passed, and I let my eyes close again. Do you dream of it? She said.
What?
I said.
What I did, you mean?
No, she rushed to say. I'm not saying you did it. I'm not saying that. I mean of before. Home, I guess. Like, do you still dream of it even though you're here?
Maybe she was trying to needle out the truth from me still.
If we talk too loud, the CO will come, you know? I said. Oh. Sorry.
My mind flashed me a single picture in the dark of our cell. It was an orange truck being licked by an orange ball of flames. And then my mind went orange and closed itself up. It's not something I ever talked about. Other girls didn't ask. No one wanted to know how charred he was when they found him in the carcass of the truck. How passers-by could only stand back and watch him barbecue. How no one could save him because then they would have gotten barbecued too. None of the girls knew how I wished him dead. It wouldn't have been so memorable to confess that anyway, seeing how many of them had also wished men in their lives dead. We could have put together a chorus. They wouldn't have wanted to know about the lists in my diary, the collection I was building of all the ways he might die, in case. Simple things, at first, domestic things. Slip on the ice while shoveling the driveway. Fall off the roof while cleaning the gutters. Get electrocuted by the blender while making a protein shake. Then I started researching. Spider bite, snake bite, wasp sting, accelerated Lyme disease. I sought out outlandish stories in newspapers. Get hit by bathroom debris from a 747. Fall in a manhole while crossing the street. I had an idea, and I got on a roll. Choke on a grape, on a peanut, on a Dorito, on a piece of hamburger meat in the parking lot of the McDonald's. I got creative, and the ideas got more violent, more picturesque. Mauled by a bear, knifed in the gut by a masked robber, run over by a trailways bus, decapitated by a frisbee, cut in half by a falling oak tree and then buried under its stump. Suicide with rope, suicide by exhaust pipe, suicide by oven, suicide old-fashioned in a warm tub with a razor. Pills, all kinds, in handfuls, swallowed until he foamed and choked. So much was wishful thinking. Shot to the head, slice to the throat, Drano in the coffee, a 2x4 with nails in it smacked over his thick skull. Set the whole house on fire with him in it and run. Car wreck was an early, obvious entry to the ongoing list. It hadn't occurred to me there'd be all those flames, so it was kind of like dying in a fire, too. If I told about my list, if I let that out, I'd have to let out the rest, like what he'd done to me or to my mom, that would prompt me to make such a list. What he may have started doing to my little half-sister because I'd seen 3 purple blooms on her arm that looked like finger marks, even though she said she just fell off her bike. These were things that I couldn't find a way to talk about in the dark or in the sun. I couldn't put them to words in any kind of light. So I made my lists instead. The thing was this. Writing something down on a piece of paper does not make it come true. It's like wishing on a set of birthday candles. Whoever woke up the next day to receive her pony. Ori hadn't said a word in a long while. Maybe she was sleeping. But I wasn't. I was awake. I was remembering. I was alive, and he wasn't. Almost every night, I said. I didn't wait for her to ask me what I meant. I was falling back into it, as I'd been before she'd woken me. I was sinking, lowering, dropping, seeing the flashes, the orange truck, the hot burning hand on a windshield, the drifting toxic scent of gasoline, the glorious black smoke. I wasn't there to witness it, but how I wish I had been. I was curious. I was curious about her, more and more curious. I watched her for the whole rest of the week, while she sat beside me in the cafeteria, where I told her to sit, while she stood for count outside our shared cell, where she was told to stand. Sometimes while she slept, which involved creeping up the ladder a ways to peer into her bunk, to see if she was really sleeping. She was. She slept on her back with her hands curled on her chest as if she were squeezed into a coffin. I turned away, though, in the night, whenever she got up to pee. I noticed that she scribbled letters during class. At first, I didn't know who to. And there were times when she tried to see herself in the wedge of mirror on the wall of our cell, moving around in front of it as if a different angle would illuminate what she was hoping to find. Fear scrunched up her face sometimes when she did this. Other times she looked the way she had when I first met her, which was sad, though not any more so surprised. I couldn't help but notice her feet, which had weird knobs up near her toes and rough red spots. That was how I first learned that, on the outside, the way some of us were carjackers and gangbangers, and other of us were troublemakers and bullies and mother haters, she was something none of us were. A ballet dancer. This sounded silly to us, like coming in saying you ride elephants or you paint your face white and mime to strangers on the street for nickels. But it was true. The news had flashed all those tutu'd pictures, bun-headed and serious, with what looked like deformed stilts molded to the ends of her pink feet. Lots of us had seen. And once I caught her leaning with her leg out, and then before I could blink she was practically halved and doing the splits with her cheek touching her knee. When she saw me looking, she crumpled up her legs again and slouched. "Why don't you do that stuff?" I said. "Show us or something." She had to know we sought out entertainment anywhere we could find it. We always asked Natty to sing, and we had Sherry doing magic tricks when no one wanted to play gin rummy or spit, though about half the time she guessed wrong about which card we held in our hands. Ori's face stilled. Her jaw turned to concrete. "What?" she finally said between her teeth. "Do what?" "Dance." She shook her head. "Not in here," I said, of our cell. Obviously there was no room. "Out there, or where they make us do that yoga stretching sometimes, maybe there." "I don't." She went to the mirror, which was not a mirror, and tried to look in. Then she gave up and looked at the wall. "I don't dance. But not anymore." She spoke like she'd cast it off forever, the way Leon swore she'd never again touch a drop of booze. She acted like even hearing the word made her sick to her stomach, made some invisible part of her scream out in hurt. Other than this, her first days in Aurora Hills made me think of my own. She moved through our halls under that same cloud of gummed numb I remembered being stuck inside. She didn't show fear. She knew she shouldn't. She couldn't. We'd feed on fear like we were wolves, and then there'd be nothing left to her but bones and the ugly misshapen skin of her feet. We'd leave at least her feet alone. She didn't fight with anyone, even when one of us got up in her face and tried to get a rise out of her. She didn't cry, not that I heard. Maybe she had that same buggy feeling I did. The one that crawled in her ears at night and scratched out the bad things. The one that said, "Now you're here, you'd better get used to it. You'll never leave." I didn't know because after that first night with all her questions, she'd gone quiet. I guess reality was setting in. I watched her in class for something more telling. Like I'd told her classes were a nuisance. We had them mornings, 5 days a week. It was mandated by the state. but in each subject there was just one teacher for all girls age 15 and older. When you read a lot like me, what was there to learn in a class like that? Those of us beyond the material were given a seat in the back and a book to train our eyes on and told to study on our own. In this way, I taught myself algebra. I interpreted the symbolism in Shakespeare plays and made up my own answers. I considered the philosophies of Plato and Kant. I learned to knit from a book without needles and without yarn. I memorized the names of Egyptian pharaohs and European dictators. I did the same practice tests for the general equivalency diploma over and over until I aced each one. Ori ended up in a seat in the back of the room, too. She got the Book of Pharaohs, now that I was done with it, and she sat, eyes glazed, chin bobbing over the two-page spread of Cleopatra, just as I had, admiring the majestic gold crown. She got out a piece of paper. She asked for a pencil. I turned back to my Foundations of Astronomy textbook, mildewed and squishy in one corner, but a real find. When I looked up 43 minutes later, she was still on Cleopatra. The book was upside down. She wasn't absorbing everything she could about the Egyptian dynasties. Instead, she had her arms wrapped around the book to form a protective tent, and inside the tent she was writing a letter, furiously. The pencil made gashes in the paper, open wounds. At one point, a whole half of the page was torn away. She saw the teacher glance up, and mistaking that gesture to mean the teacher cared, she hid the letter in a random page, near Xerxes the Great. I lagged on the way out of the classroom and pulled it out, speed read it while in step for the door, and dropped it again in the nearest receptacle, a box of worn English textbooks from 1983, before entering the hallway. Loose paper without a reason to be carrying it was contraband. What I remember from my brisk skim was this. The handwriting was practically illegible, so maybe Ori should have been in a desk up front, learning basics with the 14-year-olds. But I'd caught these words. How do you sleep at night? That time we went to Great Adventure and we. Underlined, it should be you. And crossed out, rot in hell. This wasn't a love note. Ori wanted someone dead the way I'd wanted my stepfather dead. Who? And somehow, in my wildest dreams, the fiery, smoky ones that filled my head at night, there was a part of me that believed that writing did hold some kind of magic. I wrote it. Car wreck. Car wreck. Car wreck. And then it came true. Maybe Ori believed, too. Getting a glimpse at her hidden letter made me watch her all the more. We were all of us hiding something. And since we knew that as well as we now knew our numbers, which took the place of our names since we were escorted in here, trying to keep our secrets tucked in, we always had an eye out for someone else dropping one of hers. The week went on and I didn't take my eyes off her. In Aurora Hills, infractions were picked up easily, as Ori would soon learn. She'd be more careful. There were many things that would get the COs riled up. Wearing shoes inside the cells, being late for a meal, showering at off hours, or not showering enough, talking back or talking too much, laughing, they thought we were laughing at them, walking fast, they thought we were running, sleeping at night with a blanket pulled up over our heads so they couldn't see us in our beds at all times. Worse were scratch marks on our arms, legs, anywhere that could be self-inflicted. Even if we had a monstrous itch that needed scratching, we shouldn't give in to temptation. No one wanted to be a suicide, because then we didn't get to have the lights off when we slept, and no cover of blanket at night, only a thin sheet, and in the daytime, all day, in front of COs and everyone, anyone under suicide watch couldn't wear a bra. The straps could be used to strangle, we were told, thus giving us ideas. I warned Ori about becoming a suicide, but I couldn't warn her in time about every last thing. It'd take a day or two, usually, before a new girl got on the wrong side of a CO. This meant a show of force, a power trip.
The way we saw, the guards jumped us and face-planted us, and then after all this, they told us to calm ourselves down. The way they saw it, it was discipline, and we deserved it. Ori had wandered off from the line when it happened to her the first time. We were in formation, heading for lunch, when something out the window caught her eye. She drifted for the glass and put her hand on it, as best she could, what with the bars in the way. Out through that window was a bright summer's day, the blue sky with the sun shining, the green trees swaying in the breeze. A butterfly, maybe. We saw them sometimes flitting by. All of what was out there was proof of the world going on and forgetting us, and maybe that was what called her to stop. We didn't know, and it ended too fast for us to ask her. A CO, Rafferty, had caught sight of her and shouted for her to keep moving, to return to the line. She was holding us all up, and if she did it for much longer, she'd keep us all from getting chow. Some of us whined, our bellies growling, but others of us didn't want the rubbery ham sandwich of the day anyway, and looked on with faint smiles, knowing what was coming. It would be entertainment to watch her struggle, see her fly. I wanted to speak up, warn her somehow, but I kept my mouth shut because I didn't want it, next, to be me. "Spearling!" Rafferty shouted to her. She had her back to us, her face pressed between the bars protecting the window, the bright blue sky in her eyes. "Back in line, Spearling!" Her ears were plugged with memories, maybe, her head pounding with regrets. Rafferty left the head of our line and started charging. We oohed, we awed, we backed away. One of us had a weak moment and covered her eyes. Mississippi said she saw Ori grab a hold of those window bars and hold them tight. Mirabel said Ori didn't hold on at all. She only seemed shocked to be lifted off the ground, her mouth in a big, wide O, her hair a spill that clogged up the CO's eyes. We all saw her go down, though. We saw Rafferty with his hands on her, and then she was flat on the floor, her arms awkwardly crooked behind her back, and a man in uniform straddling her, and it was all some of us could do not to have flashbacks of our most heart-stopping arrests. The face-down restraint procedure may have technically been illegal to use on juveniles in our state, but that didn't stop the COs from training in it, Olympic style. The move involved them doing this thing with their arms hooked around our necks, coming at us from behind and scooping us into the air, and then sailing us forward on our stomachs until floor met face and arms bent behind backs and we could go nowhere. They held us down, our nose and lips mashed to the ground, wriggling or still, struggling or writhing or trying to kick, crying or seething or playing dead. And no matter what we did or felt or didn't do, we were theirs. We were their game. Now Ori was truly one of us. When she'd calmed enough for Rafferty to let her go, he allowed her to stand on her own. Her cheeks were tomatoes, and tears dripped off the tip of her nose. She wiped her face with her sleeve. We smirked, or we tried to meet her eyes and give a smile to show we'd been there. Or we looked down at our canvas shoes. "Now get in line, Spearling," Rafferty commanded. "Chow time." She took her space in line, which was directly behind me. She stood up straight, and with her posture and her height, she was tall and she was steady. I could have reached out, my hand behind me, and patted her on the arm. Maybe. But being caught touching would lose me even more privileges, and I'd already lost my cart. All I did was turn my neck, ever so slightly, and give her a nod. Then we started walking for the cafeteria as if nothing had happened. She didn't steal a glance at the barred window and the blue sky beyond it as we went past. None of us did. It had been wrecked for us now, like by a bulldozer. It had been blown to bits by an atom bomb. By the second week of her stay, Ori had gotten used to all the things we'd gotten used to. The face downs and the strip searches, the squat and coughs,
the shame. Plus the small things, and they added up. Being told our lives were over. Being told the electric chair should be legal even for someone under 18. Being called inmate instead of our given names by some of the COs who liked to play this was real prison. She got used to the sound of the lock turning on our cell door every night. That cold clunk. All this she survived without complaint or many questions. It was odd how easily she surrendered. It wasn't that she'd gone soft. It was almost like she'd given up. Given in. We were deep into August. We all had our life skills assignments a couple afternoons a week. Ori's job was with the groundskeeper, outside under the hot sun. She dug in the dirt and pulled weeds in the garden. She learned how to use a shovel properly, which could come in handy for burying things instead of planting them. She also had access to whatever it was that girls like Peaches and Damore were after, but I don't think that had anything to do with her enjoyment. Digging out there seemed to be the one thing she wanted to do. My life skills assignment was in the kitchen then, and I'd catch a glimpse of her out the windows, which were larger and gave more light than any other windows in the whole facility. I'd see Ori in the dirt, communing with the worms. I noticed how the groundskeeper kept his distance from her, but he must have heard the stories. He had to have been wondering about her. Weren't we all? From girl to guard, from criminal to civilian? We wanted a glimpse at the monster inside. We thought we could catch a peek sometimes, a shiftiness in the eyes maybe, a rumble. Each of us had our own monster, distinct to us. We were all different. One girl to the next, like snowflakes. But Ori's monster wasn't showing, and I tried to see it. I tried very hard to make out what was wrong with her. To have been found guilty and shipped up here? No effort at an appeal? Because I couldn't figure it out. No way she actually was innocent. Was there? The way the girls went around saying about me? Her true self sparkled sometimes, told me things in the way a premonition might have if I'd seen the light. I knew there was something I was forgetting. My mind was dragging around a heavy part of itself, like a phantom limb. It itched every once in a while. It prickled with electricity, even though I couldn't lift it out. All my attention was on Ori. I was judge and jury all rolled into one, and I was beginning to believe she shouldn't be here. For instance, the cup. The way she saw that cup, when to us it was something entirely different. We could never choose our dishes or utensils in the cafeteria. We had to take the trays we were given, and the food we were given, though we could choose to chew and swallow and digest that food, or starve, when the macaroni was extra rancid or the soup looked weird. But Ori had this one cup she liked to use from the collection in the cafeteria. Sometimes, the red cup would be among those serviced in the dishwasher and offered at the meal that day. Any girl among us might find it on her tray. There was the luck of the draw to getting the red cup, instead of one of the many white cups or one of the grays. Before Ori arrived here, it was bad luck to find the bright object there on our trays, filled with the milk or the sour-tasting orange juice or the flat soda drink we were given. Most of us wouldn't dare take a sip. Whatever filled the red cup was cursed, and we'd rather be parched than drink it down. Then came Ori, and we realized she always saw the good in something first before any bad. Even after Rafferty caught her out of line, even when she tamped herself down and got quiet, and went through all the motions without any outburst, any protest, even then. Her true self kept peeking out. She saw what we couldn't. When it came to the inmates, she saw through our hard exteriors and the teardrops needled under our eyes and the bloodied scrapes on our knuckles from our wall punching. It was like she saw that time one of us gave our only $20 bill to the man on the corner who slept in the box. Or she saw the time another one of us found the snail on the sidewalk and saved it from being smashed by walking feet, carrying its shell and slime over to the grass.
She saw our outside goodness. Those far back memories in the rear view of our old lives. And she saw our inside goodness, too. I had no idea how. She saw us as we could be, if we weren't locked up in here. She saw what the judge couldn't see, and what the public defender only pretended to see, and what our own mothers, who refused to come on visiting day, should have seen. Imagine a person who still looks at you the way your mother used to, when you were little, and too braided, and good. That was Oriana Spearling, our new inmate, the closing of our circle, our 42. So when the red cup landed on her tray for the first time, the second week of her endless sentenced weeks, Ori did something strange. Something that caught us off guard. She looked down at the bright red spot on her tray, and she smiled. This smile lit up her face. We hadn't seen her face like this, hadn't seen that smile ever, so a few of us in line stopped and took a moment just to behold it. "You sick or something?" Natty asked her. Sherry put a hand on her arm. Though there was to be no touching. "Hey, are you okay?" Ori only smiled, kept the light on, kept smiling. She turned to me. "Look what I got," she said. "Can you believe it?" We each dropped our gaze in disbelief to her warped plastic tray, melted in on one side from the defectively hot corner of the dishwasher. In the cupped compartments on the tray, there was a glop of potato, a slop of meat, a sludge of green beans, a rock-hard whole wheat roll, and a slice of yellow cake with no icing. She didn't mean any of that, clearly. In the cup hole, there it was, the dreaded red cup. It contained a bluish dribble of what we had to assume was milk. "The good cup's mine," she said, "for today." Almost like she wanted us to know that tomorrow the cup could belong to any one of us. Ori and I went down the line to grab our plastic utensils and found a table to sit where we wouldn't be pounded for taking someone's preferred seat. She slid in across from me. We kept our heads down, as usual. I put my spoon in the gelatinous glop of potatoes and took a slithering bite. When I glanced up, still, there on her face, the smile. It made me lose hold of where we were for a moment. Confused me. Happiness for no reason made a certain kind of light in here. Pulsing. Causing a blazing flare in the middle of the cafeteria. It hurt our eyes. It called attention. "This will be a good day," she said, and everyone in the near vicinity turned to look. "That's what this means," she said. Some of the girls started whispering. One of the girls at our table, Mac, got up to move somewhere else. "You shouldn't drink out of that," I told Ori. We never. I should have warned her sooner. She held the red cup to her chapped lips and took a passionate swig of the maybe-probably milk. We didn't understand. The other girls with 9 months left to their sentences, 2 years, 2.5 months, 220 days, none of us understood. A good day? The last good moment for some of us was when we thought we'd get away with it, that the cop chasing us would stumble and fall, the alley we rushed into would have a detour, a way out. The getaway car would pull up, passenger door whipping open, and speed us into innocence. That was the last we knew of good. For others, our good moments were few and far between. In the shower stall sometimes, 2 minutes left, and the running water miraculously still hot on our sore shoulders. Sneaking a kiss with a girl whose eyes reminded us of a boyfriend's outside. Sneaking a kiss, period.
sneaking a moment to ourselves anywhere, anytime. For me, it was being in the library, skimming a finger through a newly arrived book. That was always my good thing. Now, my last good thing. But Ori saw good around every gray corner. She saw a brightly colored cup land on her tray of sad, terrible food in the detention center where she was to live out the last years of her teens. And she saw promise. She saw happiness. She saw a chance to drink the maybe-probably milk out of something nice-looking for a change, which would transform the watery, curdled taste into something rich and delicious. She finished her red cup of milk, with a whole bunch of us staring. She set down the cup with a contented sigh. "That was good," she said. After that, the red cup was coveted. Girls wanted to find it sitting there, milk-filled or juice-filled or even tap water-filled, on their trays. Sometimes a fight broke out over who got to drink out of it, and twice that summer girls were sent to the infirmary or the hole because someone said she had it first. Ori made it wanted. She acted like it was lucky. And forever after, it was. We revealed ourselves. We revealed ourselves in art therapy, forcibly, in assigned groups once a week. Art therapy was run by an enthusiastic hippie and mostly involved us drawing some abomination on a piece of cheap paper, then sitting in a circle to share it with the group after. In her first session that August, my new cellmate didn't draw lumpy dragons like Damore had, or cars like Mirabelle did. No curvaceous porn star silhouettes like Natty, who always spent most of the session coloring in the plump lips. She drew something important. She didn't know it then, but it was a message directed at me. Ori drew a face. In her drawing, graphite pencil, all gray, the nose was a normal nose. The mouth was a normal mouth. The ears were normal ears. The eyebrows were thin and barely there, but normal enough. The neck was long, and no one knew where it ended because its lines swept off the page, so it could have been a giraffe neck, for all we knew. The drawing was just a person's face, in pencil. That was it. Even our group leader had few words for Ori in the sharing part of the session. This was her favorite time because she could interpret and read us the same way she liked to read star charts, digging through the murk and grime of our pasts. But the hippie took a moment of silence, eyeing Ori's plain page. "A boy," she said. Hopefully, I thought. She did seem to adore the idea of love affairs, so long as they didn't invade our circle of chairs. Ori shook her head. "A girl." "Oh," the hippie said, with an open mind, waiting for Ori to name the girl and their connection. But Ori didn't volunteer. All she was willing to say had already been said on that piece of paper in the form of that penciled head. "A very realistic portrait, Miss Spearling. Thank you." Though she suggested next time, perhaps, if she were so inclined, Ori might try letting go and giving her subconscious a big, fat yes. The hippie loved for us to tell our imaginations yes. She had no idea how dangerous that could be. She was pleased with Sherry's contribution, which was a tree with the head of a man and the feet of a bird, possibly a chicken, and spiked eyelashes made of razor blades. My own drawing was a house made of books, but where there should have been a door, there was a book. And where there should have been windows, there were books. And where the chimney should have been open to let the smoke out, a book was covering the hole, so if anyone was in the house, they couldn't get out. They'd suffocate, to be found years later, a desiccated corpse still marking its place in the book it had been reading with a knobby finger bone, head caved in by an avalanche of fallen books. As I said, I liked books.
Our hippie glowed with the miserable pride of a kindergarten teacher. She said I was finally getting somewhere. She urged me to dig even deeper next week, to push myself, to open up that book door and let us see what I was concealing inside my book walls. She wanted the walls to come crashing down. I was ready. Natty rolled her eyes. Her drawing showed she was ready too, she said. She was ready for some dick. Our group leader flushed and mumbled a canned response about inappropriate behavior, which we'd just been talked to about last week. I didn't let Natty distract me with her nonsense. I was struck by Ori's drawing. Something about that face. It was giving me memories. And the room was spinning, and all of it, the face somehow familiar, the room somehow spinning, the hippie telling us to calm down or she'd call in a CO, made me unsteady in my chair. I tipped. I recognized this face, you see, I remembered. There was something I was supposed to remember. I face-planted myself on the ground without a CO to help me. The intruder. She'd broken through our walls and saw me. Only me. And then she went running. Ori had drawn our visitor, though Ori hadn't been locked up with us that night, so she couldn't have seen her. She couldn't have known. I'd told no one. Now I remembered with perfect detail the face of the intruder. The exact same eyes, nose, lips as in this drawing. The intruder had called me not my own name, but another girl's name, one that had tugged on me then but that I'd since pushed down and let sink to the bottom of the pool of names I kept track of, which now, right then, was 42. Ori. She was the one who helped me up off the floor, now, not our group leader and not Mississippi, who'd been sitting in the chair closest to me. Ori lifted me up. Though we weren't supposed to be touching. It was an infraction that could get us both sent to solitary if the hippie wanted to be obnoxious about it and report us to a CO. Ori had a question on her face, and I answered with a question right back from mine. I was standing now, and she stepped away and let go. It was not that she was a brilliant artist. It was mostly the eyes. The frigid, deep blue eyes. Then I blinked, because she'd used only graphite pencil, which was gray, and I must have imagined the blue. "Take your seats, girls," the hippie said. The bells around her neckline tinkled. Ori folded her drawing carefully and didn't ask me there why I'd reacted so. We had all night to talk, she knew. She took the drawing back to our cell after the session was over, after rec in the yard and dinner of gray cups and mashed carrots and patties of possible meat, after lining up to walk back to our wing, after waiting for what felt like forever to walk back, after walking and standing for count in the corridor and removing our slip-on shoes before we stepped in. When our wing made count, she turned to me, and the question from earlier was still hovering on her face. We were locked in, then, alone, with our questions. "What happened?" she said. "Why'd you freak out?" I insinuated the drawing in her fisted hand. No need to say anything more because the lights flashed. We had to change out of our jumpsuits into our pajamas now. We had to take turns at the sink and the toilet and make ready to get into our bed slabs for another night. I was careful then, in those last moments between telling and not telling. I changed with my back to her, aware of her body moving, breathing, aware of what bodies were capable of, which was betrayal and lies. I'd learned that from having friends on the outside. The friends I had back at home when I was 13 were the very first people to talk to the police. They told what I'd confided at sleepovers,
and buried chat messages. On the top of the bleachers when we climbed up there to try very hard to not have fun at pep rallies. These were the true friends I'd had in seventh grade. The ones who judged me guilty before any courtroom could do the same. I couldn't recall the last time I'd had a true friend. A secret keeper. A girl who would risk the hole to help me up when I fell off a chair. I had begun to feel something for Ori. Something I'd never felt for any of the other girls who'd been in here with me, even when I knew so much about them, from reading their notes, slipped between the pages of books, and listening in on their secrets. I'd found the letter Ori had started and abandoned, but that was all I had on her. I'd heard her name at mail call and knew someone was communicating with her, but she kept those envelopes stowed away in her footlocker, careful not to let me see beyond the postmark noting they'd been mailed from Saratoga Springs. That was all I knew. And I wanted more. I wanted to know all. But she was the one who got out the next question. "You're drawing today," she started. "What did you used to draw before?" "Regular houses." She waited to see if I'd say more. Brick houses with windows and doors and chimneys, with the puffs of smoke coming out. I guess normal houses, like the ones people live in. She didn't ask if I'd lived in a house like that. I had. Or if I ever peopled the houses I drew, showed the family out front on the green crayoned grass, under the yellow crayoned sun, standing on their stick legs, holding stick hands maybe, wide smiling mouths on stick necks. I did not. We were always careful with what we produced in art therapy. We caught on to this quickly, because indicating something on the page pointed an arrow not at it, but at you. "Aren't you angry?" Ori asked me then. "You don't seem angry. You should be more angry. Your life's ruined because no one believed you." It was. They hadn't. "Are you?" I asked. "Angry?" she said. "No." Her scribbles while reading about Cleopatra had shown otherwise. She saw my face, and I expected her to flat out keep up the lie. She had no idea I'd seen it, even if she couldn't find it in the Pharaoh's book the next day. Instead, she added, "Maybe sometimes, okay? Sometimes I get so mad I don't even feel like me. But I'm here. This isn't ending. I'm not gonna wake up tomorrow someplace else like this never happened, So what's the point?" I sat on my bottom bunk. She sounded so sensible. Her feet were bare, and her toes were long and hideous, and one of the nails was wrought black and not from polish. She didn't try to hide them. I looked up at her face, and her eyes were honest. I couldn't help but wonder if I'd met her on the outside, like at school, grade 7. If she'd been my friend, like up at the top of the bleachers with the others so we could ignore the pep rally, and if I'd said the things I'd said about my stepfather, who happened to meet his maker in a fiery accident not long after. What would she have done with that information? Would she have told her parents and gone to the police, like I discovered friends do? Or would she have been another kind of friend, the good and true kind of friend, who'd have my back, who'd stand up in a court of law and say I meant no harm, who'd put her neck out, lie for me? I had to change the subject. "Who's the boy?" I was testing her. "My drawing, you mean? Why does everyone think that drawing's of a boy?" "Someone's writing you letters." There were 3 already. "That's Miles," she said so quietly I could barely hear. We needed to keep quiet anyway, because the CO would be making his rounds of the lower tier soon. The light would come, shoving in through the window hole in our door, and we'd need to have our mouths shut at that point. We shouldn't risk talking. But I wanted to hear about this Miles. This three letters so far, Miles. This boy. The last time I touched a boy was maybe 4 years ago, on accident at the town pool. He jumped off the diving board in the deep end, and his hip connected with my bare shoulder, but it didn't hurt that much. Red swim trunks with the pockets sticking out like wings. Water up my nose. The sting of chlorine. Had Miles been the one she'd told to rot in hell, then crossed it out because she'd wanted to take it back? Was he the person who'd gone with her to Great Adventure? She was doing it again, though. Like in the cafeteria with the red cup. She was smiling. He was kind of like my boyfriend. We never named it officially, but I guess that's what he was. He sure writes you a lot. Three letters already. Five. She'd hidden, too. Five? He's got to be your boyfriend, then. Only boyfriends bother writing so much. He's trying to get on my visitor list, but I guess they won't let him. I guess I don't have the clearance. Family only, so far. I said. I'd been cleared for years, and no one, not family, not non-family, not anyone, had come to visit. The thing about Miles, she started. We heard an approaching CO and we got in place in bed, fast. The noise came and went, and I looked up into the darkness over top me, and I asked her, "What? What's the thing about him?" He's the only one who believed me. The captivating idea of someone on the outside thinking I was innocent, believing it so deeply as to write me stories about it, to go on record, on paper, where anyone could just pick it up and read it. I was glad that all I'd seen of her three, now five, letters from Miles were the Saratoga Springs postmarks and her name on the front. If I'd seen the insides, the naked parts where he confessed his belief in her perfect innocence, in the idea that she was wrongly accused, it would have choked me up. It was choking me even to imagine it. Choked me, like, with tears. She sensed that, maybe. She changed the subject. But Miles isn't the person in the picture, you know? I up and said it. I've seen her before, the girl you drew. Now she was the one who got quiet. I think it was her, like in a dream. But it wasn't any dream. It was what happened before you got here. She visited and she asked for you, but you weren't here yet. I felt a shifting in the bed above me. Though the whole structure was bolted to the wall, I felt a jolt and a lurch as if it could come loose and drop us one flat on top of the other to the hard ground. But she was only climbing off her top bunk to come down to my level. She wanted to see my eyes, I think. However much of them she could make out in our patch of darkness. She must have thought there'd be a way to tell if I was lying. Here, I was more afraid of this than at the idea of her long, graceful arm reaching out in the darkness and slicing my throat. I'd heard she killed those girls with knives. Everyone was saying that. "Explain," she said. I told her about our night. She wasn't there with us then, but she was a part of us now, and I told her. The locks, how they opened, the doors, how they let go. Our pounding feet in the darkness, and the tide that took us, and the great wide-open sea. How we thought we lost Damore, the flash of electricity, almost lightning, and then that girl, an exact replica of the gray face in art therapy. I was describing her, all I remembered, every last thing. It was when I mentioned the one detail, only then, that I think Ori believed me. She had a gold bracelet with little people on it, these little ballet dancers, she finished. She seemed as frightened as I was suddenly. I made the connection. How, of all things on the girl's gold wrist, it would be the very thing Ori used to be. Like it was her, caught on the chain for all eternity. I nodded. Her eyes, I added, were very blue. Oh, she said. Oh. What? How'd she get up here? I didn't know. She was looking for me. She was saying my name. I nodded. Yes, I think she was. A dream, I said. It had to be. A hallucination, a slip of reality, a slip of memory, a slip. But to see Ori's face in the moonlight, through our narrow window slit, to see her eyes widen, the slack of shock in her open mouth, to see all that, none of us would think so. What did she say about me? She said. What did she say I did? A CO was coming and Ori jumped back up into bed. We both kept still as he made his rounds past our door, shining the light in through our hole, blazing us up and then leaving us alone, leaving us be. Finally, she leaned down. Her name is Violet Dumont, she said. That's her name. She's why I'm in here. Then she stopped talking because she'd said too much. Was Violet Dumont one of the girls she'd killed? I sat up waiting for more, but Ori's head wasn't in view any longer. She'd gone quiet now. She wasn't telling. She was learning to keep her one true secret, and she'd learned that from me. They called. They called me in first thing the next morning, a random Tuesday. There was no hearing I knew of, no counselor to meet with, no infraction to argue against. I couldn't think of any reason they'd call me in. Santa Susa was the CO who escorted me to the wood-paneled room in a part of the facility I'd never visited. He seemed oddly joyful about getting to take me, almost giddy. I could swear there was a spring in his step as he led me out of B-Wing, a jaunty tilt to his blue-brimmed cap, a bounce to his gun. "This is gonna make your day," he told me. "I don't want to get your hopes up, but this could be good." Santa Susa opened the door, and there they were, seated all to one side of a long table. The state had sent three people. Two were women, one round and mean-faced, one slim and sharp-nailed and meaner. The third was a man much larger than the two women combined, engulfing the chair he sat in. He wore a red beard, as if he'd been plucked from the great Norse myths of Thor. The Viking nodded at me. The two mean-faced women did not. The walls of this room were made from wood panels like planks on the deck of a ship. It made the room seem darker, danker, even with the ceiling lights on. It gave an underwater feeling to the proceedings, as if I were drowning and they could reach out an arm across the table and choose to save me. Or not. On the other side of the long table was one chair. That was to be for me. Santa Susa led me to it and then sat me down. I placed my hands in full view on the table. My wrists were free.
"Good afternoon, Miss Smith," the round woman said. "Thank you for joining us today," she added, as if I'd had any choice in the matter.
Then they told Santa Susa to leave us be. He'd be right outside the door, he said, reassuringly, and I didn't know if that was meant for me or for the people employed by the state who were about to be alone in a room with me. The door closed. My hands on the table stayed artfully still, like plastic mannequin hands that had all five fingers molded together. Then they told me the news. I wasn't clear on the details, and I didn't have the legal knowledge that Peaches did from studying in case she ever got a new trial, seeing as she planned to stand up and go on defense for herself. The gist was that